With an extremely active hurricane season forecast in the Atlantic Basin, all eyes are quickly shifting to all things tropical weather. We have a treat for you on episode 93 of the GeoTrek podcast. Hurricane Man, Josh Morgerman, is joining us to share about his adventures hurricane chasing through the years. Josh is the world's top hurricane chaser and holds the world record for penetrating the core of 70 hurricanes worldwide. He has more experience than anyone for going through the most extreme conditions that hurricanes can throw at us, so we can learn an awful lot from him. Hey everyone, this is Hurricane Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast. GeoTrek explores the world to tell stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. We tell stories about the physical processes that generate these extreme events, their impacts on society, and what we can do to get out ahead of these events to minimize the loss of life and property. The cost of this podcast is free, but we do ask that you share it with someone who loves extreme weather, is fascinated by natural disasters, or perhaps lives in a disaster-prone location and needs all the info they can get to better prepare for Mother Nature's most extreme events. Well, without further introduction, let's jump into this podcast with Hurricane Man, Josh Morgerman. Josh, thanks so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
It's an honor how well this podcast is performing. And I'm like, hey, why wasn't I invited earlier? Now I feel okay about it.
Josh, I've been wanting to get you on the show. I mean, there's so much that you have to share that our listeners are going to love. You hold the world record for penetrating the most hurricane cores at 70 hurricanes. That's just mind-blowing to picture how many hurricanes you've gone into in different parts of the world. I mean, just share with us, how did you get into this, and did you ever think you'd get this far?
I think that, you know, being a hardcore storm chaser, and not just a casual one, but you know, the kind that, you know, you design your whole life around it. I believe it's something that you're born with. I don't think it's a hobby that you take up. I think it's like you're born with like some kind of brain defect or something that just makes you, you know, you're really just, you're drawn into violent weather and you don't know why. I mean, I just remember when I was a toddler, you know, as far back as I could go, you know, I grew up on Long Island in the East Coast. You know, when we get wind, when we get lightning and thunder, anything just got me excited at a really young age. And I feel like that feeling is still there. It's a very innate thing. And now that I'm a grown up, I could just hunt down those experiences and sort of feed the addiction. And I very openly call it an addiction.
Well, Josh, you and I have had conversations about this, and I think you've shared in recent decades, you've really refined this where your passion is really these more intense major hurricanes, category 3, 4, and 5, from what you've shared with me, right?
Absolutely. You know, I've been in so many hurricanes that I've sort of developed a taste for, you know, certain kinds. I'm almost like a connoisseur. And I've noticed that there are certain ones that I really get into, and, you know, more than other kinds. You know, I live on the Gulf Coast now because I really, there's something about the Gulf hurricanes. You know, there's just like a structure to them and a feel to them. It just, they have like an edge that I don't experience in other places. But definitely I noticed that my, the subjects that I really go for, I tend to go for the small, violent hurricanes that have very kind of tight, very sort of narrow cores with crazy wind over a very small area. I tend to be, for some reason, more drawn to those than the very big, you know, huge ones that cover like 1,000 miles and, you know, create weather over large distances. The small, violent ones seem to be my forte for some reason.
Josh, at the National Tropical Weather Conference, you've shared with all these storms you've chased, Hurricane Dorian in the Bahamas stands out to you as this exceptional storm. What was so exceptional about that to you?
Yeah, Dorian, I believe, was the peak of my career. I don't expect to ever match that conquest in terms of what I experienced and also in terms of what I measured in it, you know, in terms of data collection. So what made Dorian unique was, it was the strongest landfalling record. It was the strongest landfalling hurricane on record in North America. It's tied for first place with the 1935 Labor Day hurricane in Florida, meaning it at landfall it had estimated sustained winds of 160 knots, which is 185 miles an hour. And I was at that landfall point on Great Abaco Island in the Bahamas. So that's not just category five, that's way, way into category five. And, you know, I've been in five category five hurricanes, but that one was on its own level. I wrote it out in a little concrete classroom on a hill, and just the force of that wind, just hitting those concrete walls with the force of a thousand sledgehammers, like the force of it was terrifying, you know. And I was looking out the window through the cracks in the cyclone shutters on the downwind side of the room, and it was in the middle of the day. And I always thought, okay, my biggest fantasy is to be inside a really violent hurricane like that level in the middle of the day, so you have daylight so you can see. Well, guess what? In a hurricane like that, once you're really in it, you don't see anything. Looking through the cracks of the cyclone shutters, it's just, everything just turns white. You don't see anything. You do not see all the flying debris. You don't see the cars flying away. You don't see anything. You just see a wall of white. And then all of a sudden it lifted and the sky above was blue because we were in the eye. All the trees were sticks, cars thrown around the parking lot like toys. That's what a hurricane at that level is like.
Josh, you've shown your video footage of walking out in the eye. I mean, it's just completely apocalyptic. At that moment, did you think about changing your location, or did you go back to right where you were for the second half?
We had to change our location. So I rode out the front side of the hurricane in a room with a family, two families and three other guys. There were 11 of us, complete strangers, riding this thing out together. During the eye, we came outside. Our classroom was okay. We were in a school, but other classrooms had been torn open, walls had collapsed, and we realized that the building was not safe. So during the eye, we actually did have to relocate. I didn't want to because I was collecting data, and you can't move the instruments while you're collecting data. That contaminates them. So I had to decide what to do. The problem was, out of the 11 of us, I had one of only three functioning cars left. Mine was still working, and I felt a responsibility to help get everybody to safety. So, because several people had to pile into my car, and like a caravan, we got a little bit down the highway to a government building where we rode out the backside. And I'll tell you, that was the scariest drive of my life, because I knew we were in this category five, I mean, just maximum strength hurricane. And I didn't have radar because we didn't have any communication. So I didn't know when the backside was going to hit. And the thought of being caught out on that road in those 185 mile an hour winds was that idea really spooked me. And thank God we got to the government building just in time as the backside started to hit.
Wow. So how long did it take to change your position there in the eye of Dorian?
You know, it's a blur and I don't remember. It wasn't too long. When I measured it on a map afterward, I think it was like 2/3 of a mile, but it felt like 10 miles emotionally. Yeah. Like 10 miles.
Knowing this beast eyewall is out there and you can't track it, it probably felt like 100 miles, even though it was like less than a mile. Just the panic I think any of us would have felt at that time. You're describing it really well.
I was pretty spooked by this one. I felt the ferocity of it. You know, when you have a hurricane like the air, when you have a hurricane like that, the air is just filled with flying debris, and it's the kind of stuff, sure. You know, flying 2x4 or a piece of tin hits you, you won't even know it hit you. You'll just be dead. And it's sort of the thought of instant, just sudden death in those kind of like that kind of flying debris. It's a scary thought.
Well, it's just so violent, and you'd already seen what it's capable of doing, right? And then you're there changing your position. I thought it's really interesting, too, that you felt a sense of obligation to help out these other people. I know you go in there to collect data. You've said at conferences you're kind of like a scientist hunting dog that's going to go out there and get the data. But along the way, there's been a lot of documentation of you helping people out in these worst case scenarios. Like, I think, was it in Haiyan in Tacloban? I think there's video of you in waist deep water helping this woman on a mattress, right? So it sounds like when people are in need around you, you'll kind of maybe put the science aside and do the best you can to help them if people need your help right in front of you, right?
Yes. You know, it's happened a few times. You know, I'm very, you know, I've often said that I'm documenting the hurricane and measuring what's happening. And that is my passion. And I this is going to sound really callous. I'm not interested in the human impact. That's not what I'm there to do. But, you know, time and time again, you know, you're a healthy, able-bodied, strong guy in a cataclysmic situation. You know what? You could be useful. And so that's happened a few times. And like with Super Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, you know, that was a category 5 typhoon. The city I was in went underwater. The first floor of our hotel filled with water and people were trapped in their rooms and they couldn't open the doors and the water was going up and it looked like they were going to drown in their rooms. And the thought of I literally thought I was going to watch people die right in front of me. And just the thought of that, like, it just really freaked me out. And I just, like, just jumped in that water, you know, and went across the foyer, which was all flooded, you know, and just, we just started smashing the windows and pulling people out one by one and getting them out. I mean, I just, it, you know, it reminded me of like those 9/11 videos when you see the people at the top of the Twin Towers, it's burning and you see those helpless people at the top. And it just, your heart aches when you see that. Like, it felt like that, but I felt like, oh, but I could do something. I could jump in that water and I could help. And I just, it was like an instinct thing. I just did it. And, you know, I got really lucky. I don't know who was protecting me or what, but I only had scratches and bruises. One of my chase partners who also jumped in the water to protect, to help people and rescue them, there was debris and wreckage under that water. And my friend, Mark Thomas, he tore his leg open on that debris while helping to rescue people. And it got so infected that by the time he got back to Taiwan, he's British, but his wife is Taiwanese and they live in Taiwan. By the time he got back to Taiwan a few days later, he was one day from amputation. That's how infected it got. So I got lucky. For some reason, I was in that water and my legs just missed that debris. But there's risks involved.
It's a good reminder that floodwater can have all kinds of debris, displaced animals, right? Pollution, chemicals, backed up sewage. Floodwater can really be dangerous, right?
100%. And I think that's something I'm more aware now than then. But just even on a normal day, you know, if you go in the Gulf of Mexico and you get a cut, you need to like really keep an eye on that, because even on a normal day, just normal, like water in the Gulf of Mexico, there's all kinds of natural bacteria that could really get you. I didn't know about this stuff. I just started learning about it recently, but yeah, storm surge water, for the reasons you cited, is even more dangerous.
I think a lot of us early in our careers just were more lucky than we realized, right? That we made it through these things without amputations or really bad injuries, right?
Exactly. I look back at, you know, the 70 hurricanes I've been in, the amount of times I've been in a building that collapsed, the amount of times I've been, you know, crawling over a floor with broken glass, like cutting my legs open, just all the crazy experiences I've been in. And just that my worst injuries have been scratches and bruises, a strained muscle, a dislocated shoulder. I mean, a nail through my foot. I've been lucky.
You've been very fortunate along the way. Josh, I wanted to go back with you to the Bahamas in Dorian. And you mentioned, although they took this beating for hours, Cat 5 plus winds, right? A lot of the buildings actually did surprisingly well, right? Explain that to us and what you saw.
Yeah, you know, every nation has its talents. And one of the talents that the Bahamas has is when they're serious about building for a hurricane, they know what they're doing. And that was one of the things I noticed, that the houses and buildings there that were up to their codes performed spectacularly. So the main government building that we got to, it's the main government building in the town of Marsh Harbor, which is sort of like the unofficial capital of Great Abaco Island. That building was built properly for crazy hurricane winds, and it was basically looked untouched. The roof had not come off. They have impact windows, so they weren't shuttered or boarded. There was a special type of window that just doesn't break, and that building got through really well. There was some damage to like sort of decorative columns and things, but none of the structural elements had any issues. And I also noticed some small houses here and there, same thing, ones that were built properly and had this certain kind of roof called a standing seam roof. They survived those crazy, crazy winds. And that informed some of my thinking once I decided to build a home in a hurricane prone place.
Josh, let's transition the conversation to talk about that. I know that you've spent a lot of years in California and you were chasing long distances. And it seems like around the time of COVID, you were like, you know, it was hard to get on planes, right? I think from what I've heard you explain, you were looking for a place more central for hurricane chasing. Where is that place you chose? And tell us about the hurricane house that you've built there.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. During COVID, remember when no one was getting on airplanes? And I'm like, okay, if I want to chase in the 2020 season, I've got to live in hurricane country. So I picked what I considered to be just sort of a midpoint so I could drive to landfalling. And that midpoint was the Mississippi coast. And I rented a little cottage in a town called Bay St. Louis. And then, you know, 5 years later, you know, I built a house here because I love it here so much, you know, not just the hurricane history and this feeling of just kind of being kind of like in the front row, you know, just like just kind of as a spectator and a chaser, you know, I'm finally like in my element, but also coastal Mississippi and the quality of life here. It's just amazing. So so I decided to build a home, and Bay St. Louis in particular has had some of the most catastrophic hurricane impacts in American history. It got a direct hit from Category 5 Hurricane Camille in 1969, second strongest hurricane on record to hit the United States. The eye of it passed right over Bay St. Louis. It was devastated. And then it was ground zero for Hurricane Katrina with its massive record. This place has seen the worst of the worst, and I built my house with that in mind.
So, Josh, that's amazing. I mean, we know that they've had some big surges there, but also these wind events. I think you said Camille, the sustained was around 175 miles an hour. Is that right? And I know it's still up for debate, but I think that's the official estimate right now, right?
Exactly. The National Hurricane Center has been doing what they call reanalysis of history. Back and they look at the data again, but they use modern methodologies for estimating wind speed and extrapolating. And the modern reanalysis of Camille, which happened within the last decade or so, put the sustained winds when it made landfall in Mississippi at 175, which makes it officially the second strongest hurricane on record in the United States. So yeah, so this was a big impact. Bay St. Louis town area was in the eye for 10 minutes. And a resident here at the foot of the bridge near downtown measured 904 millibars, which your weather nerd listeners know that's crazy low. And that was actually the basis for the reanalysis, was that pressure reading from downtown Bay St. Louis.
So, I mean, Josh, there you are in a place that's had an observed Cat 5 hurricane landfall in the past 60 years. And also Katrina, the highest storm surge level on record in the Western Hemisphere. And you're building, you're choosing to live there, and then you're building a hurricane house there. So what are some of these adaptations that you put into this hurricane house that you built?
Well, the first thing was, you know, I was very careful about the land that I chose. You know, I chose a lot where, you know, it has reasonable elevation. One of the problems, I mean, Hal, this is your area of expertise, and I've learned a lot from you, but, you know, Mississippi is especially prone to surges because of the bathymetry, that the slope of the continental shelf offshore is super, super gentle. You know, as I always say, I hate going to the beach in Mississippi as much as I love it here, because you can't get in the water. You walk a mile out and it's still only up to your knees. Like, you have to lay down to get in the water. And that shallowness, of course, creates huge surges. So Mississippi is especially prone. And also the land in Mississippi is all very flat. So I picked a part of town that's a little higher. It's Old Town, which makes sense, of course, that the old part of town is going to be high because those old pioneers, they were smart. They knew these things. So my land is at 19 feet. And I had the house is raised several feet above that. So the floor of my house is 23 feet, which is high enough to escape anything storm surge wise, except another 300 to 500 year events like a Katrina. You know, I figured even if I eat right and exercise, I'm only gonna be around maybe another 50 years at best. So I think I'm cool with those odds. And then I did a bunch of stuff with the house to make it super wind resistant. So if we get those crazy high Camille-like winds, the house should get through it just fine.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, in your presentation at the National Tropical Weather Conference, you talked about working with the builders. You were very involved in the process, which I thought was really cool, that not only did you have this house built, but you knew a lot about how it was constructed.
Yeah, I mean, I got really involved, and I think sometimes I probably drove the builders a little crazy, like being neurotic. I was like, more straps, more reinforcements, more. And finally, my builder was like, there's going to be too many nails and screws in this wood. Like, we got to.
Yeah, Josh, so, you know, something you did that I thought is amazing is you really looked in detail at land elevation. You thought, because surge is really all about elevation, right? It's getting up above the water. And then as far as wind, though, that's where we can take, I think it gets more complex and we can take more ownership in really looking in this. What's the biggest thing you did to mitigate wind damage? I mean, if there was one big thing you learned that you would tell people that want to reduce wind losses, what would it be from your hurricane house?
I would say I can't reduce it to one, but I could give you like a few things really fast without getting into too much detail.
Sure.
One is just some simple things like using two by, if you're doing stick built houses like we do in the United States, use 2x6s on the exterior walls, not 2x4s. That's one thing. I always think the most important thing, rule number one, is make sure that roof stays on. If the roof comes off, it's game over. Like you're screwed. So, and that's based on my experience having been in many violent hurricanes. So I went with top of the line roof. It's called a standing seam roof, and it's a kind that the screws are underneath and they're not exposed. And for a variety of reasons, it just, they stay on better. But those were the roofs that stayed on in Hurricane Dorian in the Bahamas. So I wanted that roof. And then the other thing is making sure that the windows are protected. Now you could do impact glass, or you can have some kind of like window covering, like a shutter system. I went with a shutter system, but if the roof stays on and if you cover all the windows, 99 times out of 100, you're going to be okay in any hurricane.
Josh, really good advice there. You know, those are a few basic things that people can think about there if they live in a coastal county or coastal parish. Josh, I wanted to say too, I've spent enough time in hurricane zones. I start talking to locals and they start making these generalizations like the water never comes up really above the marina, or, oh, the first half of the hurricane is going to be worse than the second. And you start talking to them and they're making these generalizations based on a sample size of maybe two or three hurricanes in their history. You've been really penetrating the core of 70 hurricanes. So you've seen a lot more than anybody else. I mean, what are your thoughts on this? Do you come across people that generalize? And what have you learned just from having this huge sample size of all these different hurricanes?
Yeah, it's a great point. Tremendous variety. Hurricanes are like people. And if you could think of the variety of people that you know in terms of their body shape, their personality, their vibes, hurricanes are the same way. So there's literally, there's no generalizations I can make about them. I've been through really bad hurricanes where exactly an hour, and I've been through ones where it lasted 12 to 24 hours. I've been inside the eye of a hurricane for 2 minutes. I was in the inside the eye of another hurricane that was 7 hours. Okay. I've been in a bunch of hurricanes where the front side was really bad, and then after the calm eye passed, the backside was really weak. I've been in a bunch of hurricanes where the front side wasn't bad at all. Calm eye, the really crazy stuff happened. I've been in hurricanes where both sides were the same. I've been in hurricanes at every time of day. I've been in hurricane. Just there's no generalizations that could be made is what I'll say. Someone who's been in 70, each one is different, and I've learned to just kind of accept that and not assume anything.
Yeah, it seems like seeing all these hurricanes showed you there are all these different characteristics. And you know, I'm sure you've been in places where people say hurricanes always hit here at night or whatever it is, right? So probably from your experience, but also when you look back in the historical archives, once we start looking back 50, 100, 120 years, right, we start seeing, oh, some of these generalizations maybe don't fit your experience, but they also don't fit the history of a place if you look back far enough, right?
Oh, 100%. I'm sure that, you know, in your work, you've had this experience too, where you've done research, you know a lot about it, and then you talk to locals, and they'll just swear things that were like possible, or that you know didn't happen, and you know, how do you deal with that? I think when I was younger, I used to like very stridently correct them and be like, no, that's not what the Hurricane Center's report said. As I've gotten wiser and more mature, I just kind of sit back, I listen, I hurricanes are emotional experiences for people, and they're traumatic experiences, and they're, you know, when someone's like reliving trauma, you don't want to be like correcting them. So I found, you know, it's better what I do is I just kind of listen and say, oh, that's interesting. Ask follow-up questions, try to understand why they're saying what they are saying, and just kind of leave it alone. But I've gotten sort of more in the habit of just kind of like not correcting people, but just trying to, when I'm posting online or when I'm talking on podcasts, I'll share what I believe the truth and the correct, like, sort of order of events to be.
That makes sense. So you're kind of, you have your perspective, and it sounds like you're maybe getting in less of these argumentative discourses with people that are convinced a tornado hit their house, even though the NHC says there were no tornadoes in that area, right?
That is the most common. I would put that as the top, like, you know, probably false claim, is that when people are on the inner core of like a category three or higher. And, you know, the wind is crazy once you get in the core of an intense hurricane, you know, and that's a very rare experience. Most people will go through that once in their life at the most, even if they live on the Gulf Coast, where they're really in the worst part of a major hurricane. And once they're in that, it's not like what they expect it to be. And it's wild. And the wind is just blowing in every direction. It's just, you know, like their house is kind of, and it's crazy. And they think, oh, that must be tornadoes. It's like, no, that's actually just the inside. That's the inside of a bad hurricane. That's what that's like. But people again and again, it's like they have some prejudice against straight line winds. Like straight line winds couldn't have done that. It must have been a tornado. And it almost never is. One last thing I'll say is, you know, the way hurricanes are structured, hurricanes do produce tornadoes, but those tornadoes almost always happen in outer rain bands, far from the worst of the hurricane. Once you get deep into the worst part of a hurricane, the eye wall, that part of the hurricane almost never produces tornadoes. It might produce localized eddies or things called mesovortices, but tornadoes as we understand them generally don't happen in hurricane eye walls. So it's generally probably an incorrect recollection.
Maybe the intensity of the eye wall is just so far beyond what a lot of people can imagine that they can't imagine that straight line winds could have done that damage, right?
Absolutely. Listen, I've been in so many hurricanes, and even me, when I get inside, like when I get in the sweet spot of a category one, I'm still filled with wonderment. Like, I'm serious. Like, you're in a good, healthy category one that's strengthening as it comes in, and you get just in the sweet quad, man, I still am like, whoa, you know, like it still impresses me. And I should not be impressed after this many times, but I am. Hurricanes are wild, you know, even category ones, they're like crazy events.
Josh, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I know this is going to be such a treat for our listeners to hear about all your experiences, all your perspectives. I know you've done extensive work with the media. You've done different movies and TV series and documentaries. How can people find your work online if they're like, who is this Josh Morgenman guy? Who is Hurricane Man and how can I find him?
Well, I've started a couple of streaming series, one a British series called Hurricane Man, which I think you can get on Amazon Prime now. It's like it was on Science Channel. And my more recent series, Mission Hurricane, another streaming series. And if you just want to follow me on social media, on most of the major platforms, especially Facebook and X, you can find me at iCyclone, the letter I, the word cyclone.
Awesome, Josh. Really appreciate you coming on the podcast. The seasonal forecast looks like it's going to be a really active season this year. We know you'll be putting in a lot of miles wherever these storms go. We're excited to follow you online. Wishing you a safe season, but I know you'll be out there getting excited about it and learning a lot that you can share with the scientific community as well.
Well, I want to thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks, Josh. Really a pleasure. Can't wait to cross paths with you again in the future and to see what this season holds. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, man.
Thanks so much, Josh, for coming on the podcast and sharing all of your amazing experiences with us. I love the fast pace and dynamic nature of this interview. We covered breathtaking accounts of Josh and some of the strongest storms ever observed on the planet, got a glimpse of the unimaginable impacts from hurricane wind and flooding, and even gained some insights on how to build better in hurricane country. Something I really enjoyed about our conversation was Josh's reflection that we cannot stereotype hurricane hazards or make broad generalizations about what they're like. Keep in mind, my friends, that Josh has come to this conclusion after penetrating the core, that's the most intense part of a hurricane called the eye wall, for 70 hurricanes. A lot of times I hear people making broad generalizations about hurricanes from people who have only been through maybe two or three events in their lives. Such generalizations can be deadly because every hurricane is unique, and the next storm may have a very different combination of wind speed, duration, rainfall, and storm surge flooding than the ones you've previously observed. I like Josh's analogy that hurricanes are like people, and every person is unique. Well, thanks again, Josh, for coming on the podcast. We'll make sure to follow you closely this year in what is forecast to be an extremely active Atlantic hurricane season. Thank you also to our listeners for making us the number one podcast on the topic of natural disasters, according to FeedSpot. Your loyal listenership to the GeoTrek podcast and sharing this content with family and friends has put us in the number one spot, and we really appreciate you for that. Try to get outside and look up at the sky during this wondrous spring season. Stay safe in extreme weather, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.